Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Good morning, hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Colorectal cancer accounts for 9% of all cancers. It is the third most common type of cancer and the fourth most common cause of death. Beating this cancer is highly dependent on catching it early, and this is done through screening. What are the modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors for colon cancer? What are the current screening guidelines? Is colonoscopy the only option? Today, on Line 1, we will be discussing colon cancer and screening with gastroenterologist Dr. Doug Hagigi. Please give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. You can also email me at line1, that's spelled out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Hagigi, it is a pleasure to have you on Line 1 today.
It is my pleasure, Dr. Clark. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I know you've been a guest before, but this is the first time we've been on the show together. And I do want to give our listeners a little bit of an opportunity to hear about Doug Hagigi, how you got to Alaska, what you do, what your training is. Perhaps you can give our listeners a little background about yourself.
Well, I certainly wasn't a straight arrow. I was formerly a dentist and was going to be an oral surgeon. Switched gears. I'm from Ohio originally and went into medicine. Did training at University Hospital in Case Western for internal medicine and did my gastroenterology training at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation where I served as the chief fellow. I practiced in Cleveland, Ohio for 2 years and moved to Alaska with my wife and three young daughters at the time in 2007, and we have now looked back, and this is my children's home.
Oh, fantastic.
And currently, I'm with Internal Medicine Associates, and I've been here for 15 years.
Great. What got you interested in gastroenterology?
Well, I like the diversity. I can see issues with the esophagus, the liver, the pancreas, the colon. I like the variety of what I do, and certainly by nature, I like procedures. And they're always something that's interested me and kept me excited. So it was a perfect match. And I'm pretty good at video games, too. So that worked as well.
It does help with those colonoscopes, for sure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there any areas of gastroenterology where you specialize or you enjoy treating more than others?
I do like inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. That is a passion of mine. Obviously, we do a lot with colorectal cancer screening, and I've given talks before on the subject. But really, the variety, again, is what I really enjoy, and that has really kept me invigorated over the years.
Excellent. Well, let's get into our topic, Dr. Hagigi. For those listeners who listen to me on a regular basis, I always like to kind of start with the normal and normal anatomy and before we get into the pathology. So, Dr. Hagigi, could you describe for our listeners sort of what's the colon, what's the normal anatomy, colon rectum, and, you know, where do we start off in a normal phase?
So the colon is the also termed the large intestine, and that is, some people will say the colon is as big as you are tall. Now, that might be a wise tale. But the end of the colon is the rectum, and that's where I start. And then we have what's called the sigmoid colon. I'm going backwards. And the descending colon, the transverse colon, and then the ascending colon. That ends up in the cecum, which is the connection area of connection between the large bowel and the small bowel.
Excellent. So food and water and all of that stuff comes from this, goes to the stomach, then the small intestine, finally into the colon and its parts.
Right. So the main function of the colon is to absorb water. So it's always great to stay hydrated. And I talk about that with patients, and as well to make feces. And that's its main job. I will say you can survive without a colon. It's a little bit more difficult once we get into the small bowel because of nutrition and absorption. But because of certain disease processes, there are several people out there without a colon.
So definitely able to live without the colon, but it's useful in terms of water resorption. It does not play a big role in nutrient absorption, right?
Micronutrients at best, but again, the majority of the absorption is upstream into the small bowel.
Okay. So let's go through the numbers from an epidemiologic standpoint. You mentioned this in our conversations before. Our talk today and also in my lead-in, but it's a pretty darn common cancer.
Yes, unfortunately it is. It's the third most common cancer in the United States for men and women. There are about 150,000 cases diagnosed a year. 100,000 of those are in the colon and about 50,000 in the rectum, and treatment varies a little bit based on where the lesions are. But unfortunately, there are 50,000 deaths a year because of colorectal cancer. A male has a 4.3% lifetime risk of colon cancer, while a female has a 4% lifetime risk. And I think you mentioned in the opening, these account for 9% of all cancers' deaths. The most frustrating aspect here is that colon cancer is a preventable disease with screening.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's why we're going to go, through the screening and the guidelines a little bit later in the show. But it's so important that, and we'll go through maybe, why that is. But let's talk first about the risk factors. And so there's a lot of different risk factors for colorectal cancer. Some of them are what we would term modifiable, which means you can change them or lower them. And then some are non-modifiable. So why don't we start with the things that people can do put them at risk for colon cancer and what they can do to lower that risk, the modifiables.
Sure. So I will say, first off, the first risk factor is age. And there had been an increased risk of colon cancers in the fifth decade. And as many of your listeners may know, traditionally we'd say screening colonoscopy at age 50. That has been moved to 45. So to your point of what someone can modify with or the actual risk factors, so first off, from a dietary standpoint, there seems to be an increased risk with red or processed meats. Several studies have suggested an increased risk of colon cancer with a diet rich in red or processed meats. Further studies are needed, but this is something to be cognizant of. Lifestyle choices such as smoking as well as alcohol absorption increase formation of polyp and cancers. And I hope by saying that I haven't ruined your backyard barbecue, Dr. Clark, or your audience, but these are issues that we have to wrap our arms around. Now, on the positive side of things, there are several factors which potentially can be protective and decrease the risk. The numbers are variable, but they suggest that physical activity, a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, may be helpful. There have been other studies with regard to calcium, vitamin D, garlic, and fiber, as well as magnesium, but the evidence is somewhat nebulous. I often get asked about nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories and aspirin. And again, some studies say that this is protective, others do not. In some disease states, this may have a greater role. But ultimately, I can say there's no downside to exercise 150 minutes a week if you can, having a diet high in fruits and vegetables, and minimizing red meat as well as processed meat. Okay. From an alcohol standpoint, you want to drink in moderation.
Sure. So from a red meat standpoint, we're talking about beef, and that sort of meat. What would be processed meats? Is that things like hot dogs and stuff like that?
Yes, correct. So hot dogs, your fast food chains, sometimes they're not true beef, if you will. These are things that, would portend to somebody being more in line with fruits and vegetables juxtaposed to a diet high in red meat. 100 grams would equate to about 2 hot dogs of processed food.
Okay, and what is it about red meat? Is it something in the meat, like carcinogens, or is it the texture, or like does it cause more constipation or issues? Why red meat, do you think?
So a couple things. They do say charred red meat. So coming from a barbecue, and I referenced that a few minutes ago, and then just I think a higher fat content. And, you know, in terms of risk factors, there's also obesity, and obesity can increase your risk of polyps and colon cancer by 1.5 times, and that obviously is a radio show in and of itself, because that is a huge public health issue that we're facing in our country today.
No, absolutely, and I see it obviously in my practice a lot.
Correct.
As a bariatric surgeon is one of our patients' biggest goals for losing weight is to reduce their cancer risk, particularly of colorectal cancer and breast cancer and those sort of things. But go on, Doug.
And to your point, you know, I often get asked why, you know, are we seeing cancers earlier than we have in the past, and why did the screening protocol go down to 45? I really think it really has to do with processed food and obesity. I believe that to be the case, because things have just ballooned, excuse the pun, over the last 20, 30 years. The data is out there, and it's frightening.
Right. The different hormones involved as well. What about diabetes? Is diabetes a risk factor for colorectal cancer?
So great question. The data is still not clear, but there in one study, there was a 38% increase risk of colon cancer in diabetics. Now, further studies will delineate if we actually have to have a special screening protocol for diabetes, but a lot of times diabetes and type 2 diabetes go along with obesity, so it's in the same vein.
So it may be hard to tease those out necessarily as individual risk factors.
Correct.
Got it. Okay, I want to give our listeners our call numbers one more time as we continue our conversation on colon cancer. 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. That's 907-550-8433. Or email me at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Higigi, we mentioned modifiable risk factors. So nutrition, red meat, obesity, diabetes, smoking, alcohol, all of these things are modifiable or things that people can change about their life. Now, there are also non-modifiable risk factors, and these may arguably be just as important, if not more important, for someone's colon cancer risk. So you mentioned one, which is age. What are some other non-modifiable risk factors?
So we talk about race and ethnicity, and that increases the risk of colon cancer in some groups. In particular, African Americans have a 20% increased risk in colon cancer compared to Caucasians, with an increased risk of mortality at 40%.
Wow.
However, and this is more eye-opening, here in Alaska, there is a significant burden among Alaskan Native population who have the highest colorectal cancer incidence rates in the country. 89 people per 100,000, and a mortality of 40 people per 100,000, which is double that of African Americans. In terms of reasons, they're varied, but have to do with dietary lifestyle as well as the disease-associated risk factors we discussed, coupled with the fact that a recent study found that in Alaska, there seems to be the lowest level of colorectal cancer screening prevalence in the nation. Moreover, the primary mode for which we screen for colon cancer is stool testing, as endoscopic services are limited. And we'll talk about screening later on, but ideally the gold standard is a colonoscopy.
Right, and there are some other means, but colonoscopy is still the most sensitive at detecting issues. Okay.
And as you're to that, further the point, if you have a positive note to have blood in the stool, the next step then is to get a colonoscopy. And so there's layers where you're going through which may not be able to be followed through just by a bottleneck situation.
Sure.
So obviously we have a lot of work to do here in Alaska. And there's also family history.
Okay.
So this is important as well. If you have a first-degree relative who has colon cancer, your risk is 2 times that of the general population. And if you have 2 second-degree relatives, say an aunt and a grandfather who had colon cancer, again, your risk is 2 times that juxtaposed to the general population. That is why there are special screening recommendations or surveillance recommendations in for people with a family history of colorectal cancer. This typically starts at age 40. However, if you have a first-degree relative...
Okay, and what's a first-degree relative for our listeners?
So that would be a brother, sister, even a son or daughter, father, mother. If you have a first-degree relative who has colon cancer, say at age 48, you would have screening at age 38, so 10 years prior to when your first-degree relative developed colon cancer. And so the protocol is whatever is first, age 40 or 10 years younger than when your first-degree relative had colon cancer.
Okay, so for instance, if my father had cancer at 42, I would begin screening at age 32.
Correct.
Okay, excellent. What about inflammatory bowel disease? Does that put you at risk of having an increased, or put you at increased risk of developing cancer?
Yes. So the two main inflammatory bowel diseases are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. And over time, there's inflammation in the colon, and this can increase one's risk of colorectal cancer. So in ulcerative colitis, it's better described. If the whole colon is involved, so the so-called pancolitis, at year 8, we typically do colonoscopies to look for any advancement towards cancer. If only part of the colon is involved on the left side, that's at year 12. The data isn't as firm with Crohn's disease, but it is something certainly we do based on time. So the longer you've had these inflammatory bowel diseases, the greater the chance that you may have colorectal cancer.
Okay.
Or progress to it, excuse me.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dr. Hagigi. I'm going to go ahead and take our first caller here. It looks like Sunrise here is calling. Welcome to Line 1.
Hi. Thank you guys for these amazing health shows.
You're welcome. What can we answer for you today?
Well, don't really have a question. I just wanted to comment that as far as the doctor spoken of the charred meat, I also have learned that that even if meat that is more well done is harder on the body than more rarer meat. And then the other thing that hasn't been mentioned as far as fiber, how important fiber is to keeping a healthy colon. And meat does not have a lot of fiber, actually, interesting enough. So I'm glad you mentioned the green vegetables and then also the refined food thing. And then you mentioned processed.
Yeah.
So many refined foods.
Okay. Sunrise, we're having a real hard time hearing you. That's okay. I'm going to kind of summarize for our listeners what you were saying about well-done meats as well as charred, and then the importance of fiber in the diet for reducing your risk. Is that right, Dr. Hagigi?
So, yeah, in terms of charred food, yes. The data with regard to fiber is not great, but I will say there's no downside to having 25 grams of fiber every day. That does help get the bowels going and so forth. And again, further studies are needed with regard to fiber, but I totally recommend that.
Okay. Well, thank you. For our listeners, we're going to take a quick break here. You are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on colon cancer with gastroenterologist Dr. Doug Hagigi.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined by gastroenterologist, Dr. Doug Hagigi, and we are discussing colon cancer. Do you have questions about how cancer develops? Call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 550-8433. That's 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Hagigi, we have a few calls coming in, which we're going to get to next, but I do want to move on to discuss polyps because, again, this is a risk factor for surgery, but also is crucially important in how the progression towards cancer. So if you could explain to our listeners what a polyp is and why it's important for colorectal cancer.
So a polyp is an abnormal growth inside the colon and rectum. And the prevailing theory is that colon cancer begins as a precancerous polyp, and that's why we do colonoscopies. We see a polyp, we take them out. There are several types of polyps, but the adenomatous type polyp is the main precancerous polyp. It typically takes about 10 to 20 years for colon cancer to develop, but this can vary.
Okay, so a couple important points there. So a polyp, they can be, you know, completely benign, or they do not necessarily progress. Certain types may not progress to cancer, but polyps in many factors or different types can be a precursor to cancer.
So again, to that point, adenomatous polyps are the precancerous polyps. So typically, we remove a polyp, the pathologist will look under the microscope, see what type of polyp it is, and based on that, we make a recommendation that, hey, you are a precancerous polyp maker, so you're going to come back at a shorter interval. And we'll talk about that, again, a little bit later. But again, the adenomatous polyp is the one that we look for and we raise an eyebrow to.
Okay. And so you take those out, and of course, if you see them, then that person may be higher risk for more polyps forming, and so you wouldn't do screening. You'd do screening more often for that patient.
Yeah, so it would be surveillance at that point because they have a history of polyps. And we talked about, you know, a history of cancer, a history of polyps. You're at risk for making them again or getting cancer again. That's why you're on a shorter interval in terms of surveillance.
Okay. And so it's interesting because you said that polyps, the thinking is that it could take between 10 or 20 years for a polyp to become a cancer or progress. And so does that play into that guideline you mentioned? Hey, if you have a first degree relative at certain age, say 42, you should get screening 10 years earlier. Is that the reason for that?
That's pretty much the reason. And again, we go by and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves too with regard to protocols, but if you have a normal colonoscopy in the general population, you'll get 10 years. With a family history, you're at 5 years. So we keep you on a smaller interval between colonoscopies, assuming there are no polyps in both those instances.
Okay, excellent. I want to take a call here from Carla from Eagle River. Carla, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you. So I have a question and a comment. The question, background, my whole family has a history of colon cancer, so my generation, and we're in our 70s, do regular colonoscopies. Within the last 2 years, all of us siblings have been told we have redundant colons. We've never heard the term. We're all too groggy to ask at the time. But what does it mean, and does it affect risk or treatment? And then the observation I have, one reason it's really hard to schedule colonoscopies is the requirement that we have someone drive us, stay there, and bring us home. That's really hard to arrange, and I have a wide circle of friends. I think a lot of people don't do it because they can't. They're not allowed to take a cab home, can't wait till you're well enough to drive your own car. It's a real barrier to treatment.
No, I agree with you, and there are reasons behind all of those rules, I assure you. But I do want to pose your question about the redundant colon to Dr. Higigi. Dr. Higigi, any comments for Carla?
Yeah, so I will say all colons are not created equal. Some colons are very easy to traverse. Other colons may not as be. So a redundant colon is just an observation by the endoscopist that it may be a little bit more difficult to get around. Those are varied. The one thing I've seen in folks who've had a redundant colon, if you will, is that they may be a little bit on the constipated side. I don't know if that was our listener or not, but it's just a finding. And again, I have seen it in relation to constipation at times. With regard to access and the whole process of getting a colonoscopy, I totally get it. And our group here at Internal Medicine at times has done Saturday clinics to make it easier. We work later in the afternoon. We know we do our best. But as Dr. Clark can weigh in as well, when you get sedation, we really can't have you drive home because of the medication and so forth. So obviously that is an issue that goes into it. On the front side of it, people have issues with the preparation as well. So there are barriers, but this is something, again, I think is very important, as we've talked about with regard to the numbers that we're seeing.
Yeah, we don't want that to be a barrier to screening, of course, but you know, you can't let someone who is just under anesthesia jump in a car and drive off, because they could certainly get into an accident, injure themselves, injure somebody else, and that's just not the right thing to do.
That's correct.
But I wanted to just clarify for Carla, Dr. Higgy, this quote-unquote redundant colon or a longer colon, does that play any increased risk in colon cancer?
No, the only issue you may have if it's redundant is visualization. You want to optimize visualization, and part of that is the prep. And when a colon may be a little bit more floppy, if you will, or redundant, you really want to make sure you get a good look.
Okay, so it just may be harder to see everything that's there, but it doesn't necessarily in and of itself increase the risk.
Increase your risk, correct.
Okay,
correct.
Thanks for that clarification there. We're going to go to a few more callers here, and we're going to get into the screening because that's, I think, the important part today. But real quick, Dr. Higigi, what are some of the signs and symptoms of colon cancer? And obviously, as we've talked about, the most common thing is just no symptoms at all, just, you know, at least for polyps. But give us the breakdown on signs and symptoms.
So great question. So I will say I do see folks who are asymptomatic for a colonoscopy, meaning they have nothing going on. The bowels are regular, no pain, no bleeding, and so forth. And unfortunately, 3 or 4 times a year, we'll see a very advanced polyp or, unfortunately, a colon cancer. So to your point, there may be no symptoms at all. But when we do have symptoms, when there's a low blood count or iron deficiency, that means that the body's losing blood somewhere, and one of the things we worry about is something in the colon. So that may be one. If you have overt bleeding or bright red blood from your bottom, again, that can be a pretty good sign that you need further investigation. If you have change in bowels, too much, too little, or incomplete evacuation, These are all symptoms that are not uncommon that need further evaluation.
So, yeah, just you don't want to brush it off. I mean, bleeding, you can't just chalk it up to your hemorrhoids or things like that. It's really worth investigating further.
I will say this. Bleeding's like being a little bit pregnant. When you have bleeding, it does need some evaluation. I was on hospital call a few months back, and they called me from the ER. There was a lady who'd had just one episode of bleeding. She had not had a colonoscopy in the past. Her blood count was fine. I said, fine, we'll take care of this. We did a colonoscopy, and she had a decent-sized polyp, but it turned out that was a cancer. And really, the only harbinger was that one episode of rectal bleeding.
Yeah, and it's easy to dismiss that as something else, but it is important to keep an eye on that. Okay, let's talk here. Diane is calling from Anchorage. Diane, welcome to Line 1.
Hi. I have to agree to the people who have a hard time getting or recovering from colonoscopy, but ever since I had the, not the light anesthesia, which gives me brain fog, but the propofol, I think it is, boy, what a difference. So I hope people will ask for that. But what about the alternatives? I understand there's the Cologuard, I believe it's called, and can detect cancer. There may be some, you know, cameras, you know, that people can swallow, probably not in the colon, but probably the stomach. And so all of these other things, and what's the pros and cons of them. And then how about stomach polyps? Do they ever turn, especially people who are on like omeprazole for long term, which does produce stomach polyps?
Yes.
Is that a problem?
All great questions, Diane, and we're gonna discuss this here over the next 20 minutes, and go into all of those options for you. But I keep listening because it'll take a little while to get through all those questions. But Dr. Higgigi, can you address specifically the stomach polyp question?
Yeah, first I want to backtrack and talk about propofol. There's sort of been a paradigm shift now over the last maybe 4 or 5 years. We use propofol with an anesthesia provider. And that's really helped significantly, and to your caller's point, people wake up faster, they have less brain fog, if you will, and we've had good patient satisfaction. One other way that we've helped optimize things, instead of using oxygen when we're insufflating the bowel, we use CO2, so you don't have that bloaty feeling afterwards. Now, on to stomach polyps. As I mentioned, all polyps are not created equal. Stomach polyps, for the most part, are pretty benign. Your caller mentioned it with regard to omeprazole or the so-called proton pump inhibitors. For the most part, they are not really an issue. If they get too big, over a centimeter, it is recommended we remove them. Very rarely do we see trouble with gastric polyps.
Great, excellent. And I do agree. I do plenty of upper endoscopies for our bariatric patients, and a lot of them are on PPI therapy, and we do see a lot of hyperplastic, just benign polyps related to those medications. So luckily,
right,
they're nothing to worry about long term.
Right.
But and then just to a point there, what Dr. Higgigi and I are talking about, there's light sedation and there's deep sedation. And the propofol is what you're referring to as the deep sedation. Lighter sedation would be things like just fentanyl and Versed. And there is a big difference in how you feel afterwards. So if you're discussing this with Dr. Higgigi in his office, asking for if you're a candidate for deep sedation may help you out there. Okay, Dr. Higgigi, let's get into the screening, because that's the meat and potatoes of our conversation. Let's just go ahead and start with the colonoscopy, because that's the big one that people want to know about. Then we'll go in a little bit to the alternatives. So,
sure.
So start by telling us what a colonoscopy is.
So colonoscopy is considered the gold standard with regard to colorectal cancer screening. A colonoscope is a flexible tube which is inserted into the anus and traverses throughout the entire colon and at times into the small bowel. The difficult aspect of undergoing a colonoscopy in the process is something we've touched upon. The day before, you have to be on laxatives to optimize the view. You have to be in a clear liquid diet. This isn't always easy, but is a necessary evil to visualize the entire colon to evaluate for polyps. sedation is required, as we just touched on. Although I will say some patients don't want sedation, and I say God bless you for that. The advantage to the colonoscopy compared to anything else we'll talk about with regard to screening is that it is not only diagnostic, meaning we can see a polyp, but it is therapeutic, meaning if we see the polyp, we can take care of it and it will come out. The other modalities will mention this is not the case. People do have to miss work when they have a colonoscopy because of the sedation and so forth.
Right. So let's go into the prep, because that's always, you know, one of the patient's biggest worries or complaints or having to deal with it. And then if it's not done correctly, it can cause problems. What is your regimen or current recommendations for a prep? What does even prep mean?
So the preparation, again, is the day before. And the whole goal is to optimize visualization of the colon. And by doing that, we cleanse the colon. I personally use Gatorade, 64 ounces, with a whole bottle of Miralax, with two Ducalax tablets. That is a lot to drink, but my thought is people, for the most part, like the taste of Gatorade. And they can pick their flavor, although we say stay away from red and purple because that can look like blood. And my sense is if you can at least get down the first 32 ounces and it tastes pretty good, just kind of get through, go slow. Because the whole goal is to get a good look in the colon. There are other preparations, the so-called go lightly, and many other iterations of that. But in my practice, I've had the most success with using Miralax and Gatorade for the reasons I just mentioned.
So the prep, I mean, as miserable as a prep can be, because it makes you poop, right? That's what you do. You clean out your colon.
That's exactly right. That is the purpose. We want to get a good look at pink, healthy tissue in there with a colonoscope.
So we want no poop in the colon. You want to be able to see all the walls, see if there is polyps, and be able to deal with everything during the colonoscopy.
That's exactly right.
And what happens if you don't get a good prep?
Well, I can take care of some of it. We have ways to lavage or clean out the colon. Sometimes, though, if there's too much solid stool, we kind of have to abort the exam and then discuss. Well, maybe we do a extended preparation for 2 days and so forth. So the whole goal is do your best the day before so we can get a good look the day of.
Okay. Excellent. And what are the risks of a colonoscopy?
So there are risks of bleeding, infection, and making hole in the bowel. Bleeding happens very infrequently. There is a risk of a tear of the colon, which occurs less than 1 in 1,000.
Okay. So it's a pretty safe procedure. Obviously, we do it all the time. It does require some preparation and work and anesthesia, but it is, from what I'm hearing, the gold standard, the best exam you can do for colon cancer.
Yeah, again, and the whole key here is we can see things and then take care of them at the same time.
Excellent.
And juxtaposed to anything else we'll talk about, that is the best aspect of this. And we're actually seeing polyps. The other modalities are seeing them either by CAT scan or they're just saying, hey, you need a colonoscopy. And again, we'll discuss the pluses and minuses of those in a few minutes.
Great. So we're going to take our last little break here. We'll come back with discuss all of the other options for screening and take the rest of our calls. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call, toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on colon cancer with gastroenterologist Dr. Doug Hagigi.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined by gastroenterologist Dr. Doug Hagigi, and we are discussing colon cancer. Do you have questions about the best option for you to screen for colon cancer? call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Or email me, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Hagighi, before we leave colonoscopy behind, I do have an email who does want to know about the age ranges of colonoscopy. What are is it still recommended for people who are 70, 80? What about 90?
So to your point, you said you wanted to leave colonoscopy behind. I see what you did there. So anyway, you know, the recommendation we talked about is age 45. And it's also recommended that after age 75, there are risks associated with preparation, procedure, and sedation, things we have discussed, that may outweigh the benefit. So for patients who are older than 75, I typically consider performing a colonoscopy on a case-by-case basis, and it's based on their health. All folks in their late 70s and 80s may be a lot different. And but I want to point out one thing. The 45 to 75 range is for colorectal cancer screening. It's not for if you have symptoms such as a change in bowel habits, abdominal pain, or rectal bleeding. A colonoscopy may be indicated in those instances to further evaluate those symptoms. So again, the 45 to 75 is just for colorectal cancer screening. That's an important point.
Okay, not symptomatology. So, and then,
correct.
And the current guidelines are every 10 years, although that may change depending on what you find on any given colonoscopy, correct?
Yes. So given the size, the number, and what the polyp, if it's more advanced, looks like under the microscope, will dictate when I need to be friends again with my patients, although I'd be happy to see them anytime.
Sounds good. So let's go through the other options. Okay, I'm going to list a few of them, and then we'll go through them. And let me know
sure.
if I forget anything. There's
sure.
going to be the fecal occult blood test, plus or minus flexible sigmoidoscopy, the Cologuard test, CT scan imaging.
Yeah.
And then did I miss anything, other options there?
So there is a FIT test. So maybe we start with the stool test. And I'm not really going to touch upon the sigmoidoscopy, which is a partial colonoscopy. It is done in conjunction with a stool test, but really not to any great extent. And the barium enema really is not done anymore for any significance.
Okay.
So with regard to the fecal occult blood test, that is recommended annually, and that evaluates for hidden blood in the stool via a chemical reaction. Your healthcare provider will provide you with a kit and stools collected, and it can be done in the home or the office. And if this is positive, the next step is a colonoscopy. Disadvantages: if the test can be negative in patients who have polyps and colon cancer. So it's not as sensitive as we'd like, obviously. And dietary modifications are needed. In particular, no red meat or vitamin C 3 days before performing the test, as this can alter the outcome. The next stool test is called a fecal immunochemical test, or FIT test, which is recommended annually, and it checks for blood in the stool. But it looks for a particular protein called hemoglobin, and compared to the fecal occult blood test, it does a much better job at detecting blood in the stool. And you don't need any dietary restrictions. And again, if positive, the next step is a colonoscopy.
Okay, so it's looking for microscopic or visually undetectable blood in the stool as a reason to do further testing.
Correct. And so that then brings us to the fecal DNA test, or the so-called Cologuard, which detects blood in the stool as well as abnormal cells shed from an advanced polyp or cancer. It detects about 92% of colon cancers and only about 42% of advanced polyps. And again, if positive, the next step is a colonoscopy. However, I would like to emphasize that if you have a positive fecal DNA test, it does not mean you have cancer. I want to emphasize this point. It just means we have to go the next step. And I've had patients who have had a positive fecal DNA test, and their colon has been completely normal. Others have polyps, and some who have actually had cancer. But it just means we have to go the next step. And I would want to mention the downside, I think, to the fecal DNA test is that it only detects about half of advanced polyps. So if it's negative, it may miss a large polyp, which could progress to cancer over time. So some screening is better than no screening, but there are certain screening tests that are better than others.
Okay. Yeah. And I think the point, one of the big points, is that these tests are diagnostic to a degree, but not therapeutic in any way.
Correct.
There's nothing that can be done with one of these tests to get rid of that finding.
Right.
I mean, you the next step is going to a colonoscopy.
Correct. And they do say that the fecal DNA test detects 92% of cancers, but you know, at the end of the day, the more important thing is detecting the larger polyp that may progress there, because that's what we want to prevent.
Yeah, you don't want to know when you have cancer. Well, you want to know before you have cancer.
Yeah. That's the whole point of a screening test. There you go.
Got it. Okay, let's take some of our callers here, and we'll get back into the testing. Aaron is calling from Chitna. Aaron, welcome to Line 1.
Hello. Good day. My question is, I've had 2 colonoscopies in 20 years. I've been diagnosed with IBS-C. I experienced chronic constipation, and I am concerned that using enemas may be a risk factor in this to cleanse my bowels.
Okay. Dr. Hagigi, do enemas increase risk?
No, they don't increase risk, but I can tell you constipation and diarrhea, we could do a whole show on that. So they don't increase risk. If it helps you move your bowels, that's great. There are medications out there other than enemas that may be helpful as well. It's something that you maybe want to touch base with your healthcare provider about.
Great. And we do have a link to your bio and your website on our Line 1 website if anyone needs to look up how to reach Dr. Hagigi. Let's
no
go
problem.
To Klaus. Klaus is calling from Anchorage. Welcome to Line 1.
Yeah, thank you. That's Klaus here. Dr. Hagigi, I have a rather strange question. I'm experienced problems with frequent urination since about 10 years. And I personally had always the feeling that there is somehow, or that it has somehow more to do with the colon than the bladder. And I wonder what the connection is there, or that even maybe diabetes. So, and the reason I'm asking that, I had recently a prostate surgery, was always told that that was my problem. That was about 6 weeks ago. And that prostate surgery doesn't help me a damn thing with my problem. And I still have that feeling that it, maybe there is a connection between the colon, because I have quite often also problems with, that I can't have a bowel movement or so, you know.
Okay. Thank
so
you, Klaus.
If there is somehow a connection that could...
Let's go through it. Thanks for your question, Klaus. Dr. He, any connections? Now there's physical connections, which we can talk about,
right.
You know, a fistula, but is there... we can mention that, but also, is there any connection between maybe bloating or diarrhea or constipation in the colon that affects bladder frequency?
So, Klaus, there's no strange question. Anatomically, as you pointed out, Dr. Clark, you know, the prostate and the rectum are right there. And it may not be a direct consequence of the colon or the rectum, excuse me, and the prostate, but sometimes the pelvic floor isn't behaving itself. There are several muscles that precipitate a bowel movement. Some contract, some relax, and maybe the pelvic floor isn't as strong, and that can translate into decreased evacuation. And so that is something that can be evaluated with certain diagnostic tests and so forth. So if constipation is an issue, there are things to look at. First, I would say let's look structurally to make sure that the colon is clear and there's no structural abnormality, and then you kind of look at function, and that falls into the arena of diagnostic imaging.
Yeah, a lot of those muscles that affect your evacuation of your bowels, you know, may also affect your bladder. They're all in the same area. So there can be a connection, and there can also be a physical connection. you know, colon can connect to the bladder. That's pretty rare. But those symptoms are a little bit different. What would that be, Dr. Higgigi?
If they're connected to one another?
Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes that can be Crohn's disease. It can be very bad diverticulitis. Diverticulum or polyp or pockets in the colon, which we see over time, and they're usually a function of the Western diet and straining and maybe constipation, but we see them quite frequently, but sometimes they become inflamed, and if they're chronically inflamed, there can be a connection between the colon and the bladder.
Right, and sometimes you people can see feces in their urine or even air bubbles in their urine, and that can be a sign of a connection. So,
and that's not good. Yeah.
I hope that answered your question. And Dr. Higgigi, before we move on, do have an email here about quote-unquote pockets, which I believe are referring to diverticula. If we could just comment on that and if there's any potential there for increased risk of colorectal cancer.
Not so much with a diverticulum. If you have diverticulitis, there's chronic inflammation. And just as an observation, we tend to see a few more polyps when there are a colon is highly infested with the pockets or diverticulum at times, especially if somebody's had diverticulitis. It's just an observation that I've had, but it doesn't. There's really not a lot of data out there to say if you have diverticulosis, that puts you at increased risk.
Okay, so not an increased risk of colorectal cancer, but you know, chronic issues that could cause diverticula may also put you at risk of a cancer.
Potentially.
Okay, excellent. So let's, with our last few minutes here, we have about 5-6 more minutes. I do want to refresh our memory, go back a little bit into these tests, because I think it's such a common thing for people. You know, they don't want to do the colonoscopy for whatever reason. Fair, fair assessment. But the other tests that they're doing, you know, you really have to be informed that they're not perfect either. So you mentioned the fecal occult blood testing and the FIT testing. Now, both of those are checking for microscopic blood, is what you said?
Yeah, so those are blood, and then you go under the Cologuard, that's looking for blood as well as abnormal DNA or cells that you see with a polyp and a cancer, yeah.
Okay, so at least for the fecal occult blood testing and the FIT testing, if you're having a symptom of polyps or cancers that's not bleeding, it's not going to help you.
Right. If you're having a symptom, there's no sense in doing any sort of non-invasive testing. You know, that is something that needs further evaluation, and usually that involves something with an endoscopy of some sort.
Okay. So bleeding is one of the primary indications for you to do a colonoscopy.
Right. So we see bleeding. It's not uncommon. Change in bowel habits. Possibly abdominal pain, depending where it is. We talked about incomplete evacuation. If somebody has a low blood and iron count, these are all things you need to raise an eyebrow about and say, listen, let me talk to my healthcare provider to get some guidance.
Okay, so also I want to mention the, and I think you touched on it before, the imaging or CAT scan, a CT colonography. Because this may be indicated for patients who can't have a colonoscopy or maybe they're older. Where does this fit into all of this big picture?
So, as I mentioned, we also talked about a barium, but that's not done very, very commonly anymore. The main radiographic modality is what's called a CT colonography. And the advantage here is that it's non-invasive and there's no sedation. However, you still have to do a preparation the day before. There is radiation exposure, and there needs to be a certain level of expertise in terms of who's reading it, because that's not always readily available. And I will say there is a risk of perforation with this test as well. And as we've discussed before, if it's positive, the next step is a colonoscopy. So to your point, who would be a candidate for this type of test? Well, sometimes we do a colonoscopy, and as I mentioned, all colons are not created equal. And it happens very infrequently, but sometimes we can't get around the entire colon to visualize this. This is something to fall back on to visualize the entire colon.
Okay, so if you couldn't see everything with the colonoscopy for whatever reason, this may be another option for patients. And you said there is a prep, and then is there dye involved? Do they have to drink dye?
No, typically they instill material into the colon rectally, and that's where there's a slight increased risk of perforation as well. And again, we talked about radiation exposure with any CT scan.
Sure. Okay. So fecal occult blood testing, FIT testing, Cologuard, and CT scan would be your primary alternatives to a colonoscopy.
That would be true, and not even alternatives, because we know that eventually, if they're positive, that's where we're going. But I will say, again, any screening is better than no screening, because the stakes are kind of high here.
Right, right. And the important thing is, like you said, if we're trying to catch these early, you can get them out before they turn into cancer.
Well, and that's the whole point of a good screening test. I mean, that's why we do the mammograms, we do the PSAs, and so forth. These are screening tests, and the beauty of this screening test is not only screens for precancerous polyps, but they're able to be removed compared to any other screening test. I mean, it is diagnostic and therapeutic.
Great. And here in the last couple of minutes, just real quickly, Dr. Gigi, what are the stages of colon cancer? What's the survival rates right now?
So with regard to colon cancer, there's several stages. 1 through 4, and if caught early, stage 1 is confined just to the lining of the colon, and the 5-year survival rate in 5 years is usually the benchmark, is about 93%. Stage 2, which is a little deeper into the lining of the colon, it's 85 to 72%. Stage 3, where there are lymph nodes, and those are certain conglomeration of cells outside of the colon that help with fighting infection, if they're involved, it can be anywhere from 80 to 30%, depending on how many, because at this point, chemotherapy may be needed. Mm-hmm. And finally, if you have stage 4, where there is disease activity outside of the bowel, maybe in the liver, for example, that's not uncommon, the 5-year life expectancy is only about, at best, 5%.
Okay. So again, here, Dr. Gigi, we got about 1 minute left, and I think I know what your take-home points are going to be, but let's express it to the audience based on that last discussion of cancer. Anything you want the audience to know here before we have to tune out?
Well, so the prevailing theory is that cancer arises from precancerous polyps, and that's what we're looking for. There's increased risk of colon cancer seen with family history and many lifestyle choices. So there are several screening options out there. Just talk to your healthcare provider for what works for you. But at the end of the day, some screening is better than no screening.
So get screened. Get screened.
That's it?
Yeah, yeah. And if people want to get a hold of you or your office, what's the best way to do so?
So me and my colleagues are at Internal Medicine Associates at 907-276-2811. We go to the Valley, and we're working our way up to Fairbanks here in the next year.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Gigi. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Special thanks to everyone involved. Thank you to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.